Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the hottest internet radio show and podcast, The Author's Lab, a place for an eclectic and lively discussion of the dynamic world of writing, publishing, and marketing of the written word. I am the sage, the host, Robert Batista. Follow me on Twitter at author R. Batista, and make it a point to follow The Author's Lab on Blog Talk Radio. Today, we are excited to have as our guest the multi-genre author, Diana Steven. Diana, welcome to the Author's Lab.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's a pleasure having you. Diana, it's so good, as I said, having you on the show. Let's start off by something that caught my eye in your bio. You being referred to as the Jill of all trades. How did you get that moniker?
Well, I've had a number of people talk to me about being a Renaissance woman, and I guess because I've reinvented myself a number of times, I've had so many different careers in my life. I'm a bit boggled myself as to how that all happened, but I guess I'm a curious person, and I just follow my instincts, and so I've tried a lot of different careers. Teaching, I was a librarian, I was a model, an actor, a family therapist for 25 years. I even worked for a year for CBC Television as a freelance writer-broadcaster for a television show called Sports Journal in British Columbia. And, and even within the field of clinical practice, I worked in a lot of different health settings. Mm-hmm.
Amazing. With such a diverse resume, I guess it was only natural for you to start writing and telling your stories. At what point did you make that jump into being a writer?
Well, you know, I really started, I guess, in my, shortly after I got married. I joined the Manitoba Authors Association and wrote a couple of newspaper articles and won an honorable mention in a fashion essay for Flair magazine. But, we had children early in my life, married, and my husband went back to school. So writing as an occupation that would bring in enough dollars to help support a family didn't seem like a good choice. So, writing was put on the shelf until I basically took an early retirement.
Right. Subsequently, your stories are diverse, crossing many genres. Was it your intention to move through different genres from the beginning?
No, it wasn't. The first one, A Cry from the Deep, which is, it's also romance, mystery, adventure, came about because this screenwriter, because I had been a screenwriter for a while. I had an agent in Toronto and Vancouver. Anyway, this guy knew that I wrote screenplays, and he wanted to, collaborate with me on a story idea he had. And anyway, we bounced around stuff for about a year, and it didn't go anywhere. And then I thought, I liked the inspiration, the idea he had, and I ran with it. I basically said, look, do you mind if I want to do something with this? And I wrote a novel, which, took me to Ireland and Provence and Manhattan, because half of it takes place in Ireland, and there's a good chunk in Manhattan. So, I love the research, Robert. Well, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, Manhattan, then, my part of town. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then the second one was a story that had been kicking around a long time. I actually wrote a screenplay that ended up being considered by Jodie Foster's agent, and she passed on it. And but it was a story that was inspired by my work on a psychiatric ward. So again, very different, more dramatic, you know, a more serious kind of story. Follows the story of three different women. One is a psychiatric intern, two are patients. And then the third one is the one that I just had published, which was based on my grandmother's life during World War I and the wars that followed in Russia. And that one is historical fiction. So, I tend to just follow whatever kind of gets me excited in the moment.
On your website, you write, "Because I like books with heart, I write about love, family, and other relationships. As a former family therapist, I use my knowledge of what makes people tick. I'm curious as to your process into using this knowledge for interpretations into creating the characters and stories in your books. How is this achieved, Diana?"
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think I marry, you know, what I've experienced with what I witnessed in my work as a
right.
therapist, you know, how people struggle with different things and you know, how they can go off the rails because of something that can happen in the family or their greed gets the best of them. And so, you know, I read a lot. You know, I've seen a lot. I've traveled a lot. And I think all of that, it gets into the mix. So, I certainly use my knowledge of human behavior and my knowledge of family systems, you know, how people communicate and relate to one another and how, you know, some missteps can get them into a jam where, you know, they don't speak to one another like for almost forever. You know, because of something that was said, it was a straw that broke the camel's back, basically. And I use all of that. And the heart, I mean, my second novel, I mean, my experience on that psychiatric ward, I think I was so passionate about what people had brought, what led them to end up on a psych ward, that I felt frustrated working there. And I think that my frustration led me to write that book because I felt that, you know, the system doesn't allow them to let their stories come out in the way they should so that people can understand how they got there in the first place and help them get back on a road where they, you know, can enjoy a healthy and productive life again and get love in their life. So, I guess that's what I mean by heart, too. And the same with even the romance, my first novel, because it's basically about a woman from the past who didn't get what she wanted in the previous life, and she haunts a woman in the present in A Cry from the Deep. And again, my family therapy experience, or my experience in mental health, was used in that novel because my protagonist ends up seeing a shrink at one point, a bit of a quirky shrink, and her ex is a psychiatrist. So, you know, much as I do research, I also use what I know. And with my grandmother, that was an interesting journey because she never talked about what happened in my latest novel. I shared a bedroom with her for the first 15 years of my life. So Sunflowers Under Fire is the name of that story. And I had to dig deep on that one and get into my grandmother's head and her heart as to what she was going through dealing with both the joys and losses that she experienced, you know, in Russia during that very turbulent period in Russian history.
Yes, and that leads into my next question. Your latest novel, as you said, Sunflowers Under Fire, is a historical fiction piece set in Russia during World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution that followed. And me as a history buff, that is such a fascinating time period for me with the Bolshevik Revolution, the Tsar, how his family was slaughtered, Rasputin played a little part in it, and then the turmoil and the murderous Stalin-era regime and everything that followed. And I know this is all based on you talking to your grandmother and, as you said, sharing the bedroom, but can you give us more information on the genesis of this story?
Well, you know, my grandmother, I shared a bedroom with her, but she never talked about what happened in her life. I had no idea of what she had gone through, and I guess,
right.
You know, I think about it like, you know, people who come back from war, and they've been traumatized, and they've seen horrific things, and they just don't want to waken up those old wounds. I mean, that's the only reason I can think now as to why I never saw her cry, and I never saw her, I mean, she never talked about it, but my mother, she must have talked to my mother about it, because my mother was the storyteller, and she told me what happened over in the old country. And then, of course, I had to do all that research. And I think what's sort of very relevant right now is this whole battle over there between Ukraine and Russia. And my grandmother was a Ukrainian farm wife, and, you know, very much wanting to have an independent Ukraine even back then, because that was, you know, the people were very passionate about what was going on. And so I think there's a seeds of all of that kind of history that comes out in just looking at this sort of ordinary woman, basically, a peasant farm wife, and how she struggles and sacrifices for the love of her family to, you know, to get through the, you know, through World War One, and then the, you know, fleeing to the refugee camp. And by the way, one of the Tsar's daughters was involved with my family, and there's a chapter with Olga about Olga Nikolaevna in the book. And and then, of course, you know, the typhus epidemic and the Bolshevik Revolution and the Polish occupation, and it just was one thing after the other.
Right.
And I never planned to write that book, though, Robert. I was collecting the stories on my computer for the family. But I'm a grandmother. I have three grandchildren, and I've been telling them these stories over time. And my oldest granddaughter, Chloe, said, you know, Bubby, you should write this book. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should, because she thought it would make, you know, and I thought, yeah, I think it would make a really good book. And especially my grandmother, who relied so heavily on faith. I mean, she was so religious, and at a time she was Christian, and at a time when, you know, we don't have that kind of support anymore. So many people have moved away because of, you know, science and lots of other reasons. And how helpful that was to her to get through that time. And we don't have those kind of crutches anymore, for many of us anyway. So I think that's also, you know, a compelling argument, I guess, for having something to hold on to when everything is lost, you know. So, yeah. And then especially today, too, Robert, with our whole the rise of populism in the world, in this fear of immigrants, when, you know, nobody leaves their country, nobody wants to leave their country, because it's what's familiar to them. It's their family, it's their language, it's their culture. And so things have to be really desperate for them to want to leave. And that passion and that drive and that struggle makes them to, you know, they become really hardworking citizens of any country they go to if they're given a chance. So, I mean, she ended up coming to Canada in 1929, and that's the, and I'm writing the sequel to that now, but what happened then? Yeah, she arrived during the Great Depression, so that's another story.
Yes, it is.
More drama, Robert.
Always. That's what keeps us going. So with any historical fiction piece, I know that research is at the forefront. How was the research process for you with this book?
Well, it turned out to be way more than I thought, because originally I was writing it as a nonfiction book. But then I realized I had so many blanks in my mother's stories. I had anecdotes, but I didn't have what happened in between those stories. And then, of course, this is Eastern Europe, and, you know, we've all been exposed through our North American education to, you know, North American history, European history, but what happened, you know, behind the Iron Curtain, so to speak, in those countries is not that well known to us, and also very difficult to research because a lot of records were burned because of World War One, World War Two on that soil. So I researched Vancouver Public Library, Winnipeg Public Library, Toronto. I went to New York Public Library, ordered books. I went to Stamford, Connecticut. where they have a huge Ukrainian language library. I can read a bit, but unfortunately, my Ukrainian language wasn't good enough, to make best use of that library. And online, I used photos. There were World War I videos. I know someone who is a professor of Slavic literature. I consulted with him. So, fortunately, I love research because, to me, I'm learning at the same time as I'm writing.
Right.
So that was, I discovered my grandmother in a way that I never thought I would. I mean, I ended up, laughing at the computer, crying at the computer. and in the end, some of my readers have said, I think about my grandmother when I read your book. Or another woman from Texas said, it helps me understand the immigrant experience more having read your book.
Right.
And someone else said, about my grandmother, who's this uneducated peasant farmer. They said, she's my new heroine. And because of her resourcefulness and her wit and what she was able to do, with not much. So I think she is inspirational. And I'm just happy that I wrote it, Robert. it just got
yes.
to it all. Yeah.
Yes. In doing this research, Diana, was there anything you learned that surprised you?
It surprised me how much truth there was to my mother's anecdotes, to be honest with you, because my mother was quite the storyteller. And, it just all clicked. Everything clicked, some of the settings, the scenes she told me about, even about, Olga Nikolaevna, because Mom told me about this encounter they had with her on the trains on the way to the refugee camp in the Caucasus. And sure enough, Olga Nikolaevna was a Red Cross nurse. There was a couple of them during the wars. They did that volunteer work. So, and then with my grandfather visiting them during the refugee camp in the Caucasus. Yeah, the Russian soldiers were nearby fighting the Turks. So, all of that, it was fascinating. It was just fascinating to discover, what people went through. Like, we're so blessed in North America not to have had world wars on our soil.
Right.
We are so blessed. And I don't think we appreciate what people go through, whether it's in, Syria or Rwanda or wherever, Czechoslovakia, with the busting up of that country. We don't appreciate. And so I think, for me, anyway, I just thank my stars every day that I live where I live. On this side, so far so good, Robert.
Yes. And Diana, I love the book's title, Sunflower
uh-huh.
Under Fire. Did you have it from the beginning or did it come later?
It came later. I struggled with that one. Boy, I called it, first of all, Lucia's Lot, my grandmother Lucia Mazurets in the novel, I thought. And so my writer's critique group, which I've been a member of for about 20 years, some liked it, some not so much. And then they thought Lucia's story, but it didn't seem right. And then I came across a post by a Ukrainian young woman who has a blog post, and she mentioned that sunflowers was the national flower of Ukraine. So that got me thinking, and then Under Fire, I don't know, because it was all during wartime. So I really played with that title and also the book cover. I mean, that was done by a Philippine book cover designer, the cover. I'm an indie author, so everything
right.
I did, I hired professional editors, professional
right,
copy
right.
editor, professional substantive editor, and anyway, I worked with him. I had an idea. I sent him a family photo, and you have a picture of a woman that he played with, and he put her in front of a field of sunflowers with kind of a Ukrainian thatched cottage in the background, which was perfect. Anyway, we worked together, and I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, that cover works very well. Diana, you have graciously agreed to read a portion of your book for us. Can you do this now and set up the part you're reading?
Okay, I would be happy to. I'm going to read the first few paragraphs from the very first chapter, which calls Duty Calls, and then I'm going to skip ahead a bit so that I can give you a flavor, okay?
Okay.
So, Duty Calls. August 5th, 1915, started out like any other day. The sounds of war echoed in the distance, but on the farmland surrounding the village of Kiberci in Volhynia, life went on as usual. That comforted Lucia Mazurets, who asked nothing of life except the means to feed and shelter her growing family. She looked out her farmhouse window at the field of grain swaying in the wind, a scene so gentle it was hard to believe that if the war moved any closer, men's blood would be spilled on the soil. She then peered down the dirt road leading to the main artery. No sign of Gregory. She'd hoped her husband would give up his foolishness and return from Lutsk, but the only movement was the dust swirling above the road. A sharp labor pain forced her to grab hold of the windowsill. She gritted her teeth and breathed deeply until the agony in her lower abdomen had passed. The pains were coming more quickly. Lucia realized she could wait no longer. And then the next few pages, we learn that she's 40 years old, alone because her children are off working in the field or doing errands. And then she takes a shot of home brew and lies down on some burlap bags and delivers her eighth child, a girl called Eudokia. So we're now to the next section. After a nap with Eudokia, Lucia placed another clean cloth between her legs to stem the bleeding and went to the kitchen to prepare supper. She was stirring cabbage with tomatoes on the stove when she heard the front door creak. She turned to see Gregory standing in the doorway wearing a soldier's uniform. Her worst fears had come true. Lucia choked back tears and showed her back, but not before she saw Gregory's eyes widen with the discovery that she was no longer with child. Her legs felt rooted in cement while she waited for an apology. None came. He stood for a few minutes as if he too was waiting for some word, and then went into their bedroom where Eudokia lay sleeping. Gnashing her teeth, Lucia stirred the vegetables with force. She tried to calm herself to avoid spilling any precious food. Not long after, Gregory returned to the main room. As if nothing out of the ordinary had happened, he came up behind her and fondled her breasts. She whirled around and pushed him so hard he stumbled on the uneven clay floor. "What?" he said, grabbing the top of the spindle chair to keep from falling. "You have a beautiful girl and you're angry? What's this?" She poked his khaki shirt. He stretched out his arms and twirled around, showing off his new uniform. "I look handsome, yes?" For a moment, she admired his fine figure in a tunic, breeches, and leather boots, but once she saw the peaked cap in his hand, her fury rose like smoke from a dying fire. The badge on his cap displayed the Romanov colors of black, white, and orange. He grinned. "They also gave me a greatcoat, a knapsack, and a rifle." "What's it to me?" "Don't say that. The Germans and Austrians are already advancing on Warsaw. Lutsk could be next." "That's what I'm afraid of." "Frown all you like, but I promised the Tsar and Tsarina I'd help fight these devils." She spat. "The hell with the Tsar and Tsarina. You promised me first." "What are you saying?" "When we got married," she said, arching her eyebrows, "the priest said we were one flesh, and now you want to tear us apart? We may have to leave at any moment. We'll be forced to run." "If we win this battle, you won't have to leave." "How do you know? Our army, biggest in the world, they say, has been fighting for a year, and where has it got us? Nowhere. From what I've heard, you'll be lucky to be fed." She shook her head. He tightened his lips. "Stop shaking your head. You only make matters worse." "And what are you going to do, speak Russian?" "The Tsar isn't stopping us from speaking Ukrainian anymore." "Oh, he's had a change of heart, has he?" She waved her fork at him. "It's probably because he needs Ukrainians to do his dirty work. Well, I spit on the Tsar. We're nothing to him." "Lucia." And what if you get killed? She put her left hand on her chest to ease the pounding. Gregory's brow furrowed. I'll be safe. You'll be safe, too. The government is organizing shelter and food for refugees. Ha! As if they could organize anything. She checked the cabbage, found it tender, and took the pot off the stove. Don't worry, you'll be sent somewhere with the children. Somewhere, she said, glaring. How will you find us? I'll find you. Don't worry. Oy, you have an answer for everything. Are you forgetting I just had a baby? You may as well draw me with the family, then you'll know where to find us. Enough already, he said, stamping his foot. I have to pack. They're sending me to the front. Go then. You want me to leave like that? His warm brown eyes searched hers, begging her to understand. I will need your prayers. At that, she softened. With a lump in her throat, she said, I will pray for you and the others. You're a good woman. If I was so good, you wouldn't be leaving me. Don't say. His eyes glistened with the sadness she hadn't expected. For a moment, she thought he might change his mind. But then he turned and went into their bedroom to bundle up his things. So that's...
Excellent. And what I loved was the dialogue. It was so crisp and just drew you in. It just drew me in. So it was excellent.
Thank you.
So you're welcome. Diana, you're welcome. Diana, a review of Sunflowers Under Fire on Readsy.com by Anna Brill states in part, Diana Steven masterfully weaves together the history of her family, the history of Eastern Europe during World War I, and the rise of the Bolsheviks, and her own imaginations. I will say that it takes a fair amount of emotional endurance to read this book, as readers will get attached to the characters, and these characters suffer immeasurably. Wow. If readers need emotional endurance, Diana, then I'm thinking you must have gone through the emotional gamut in authoring this book. How far deep down the rabbit hole did you go, emotionally speaking?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I think all of us have this rich history if we could go back. And you know, we're all so busy with our lives. And this was a gift to me, Robert, to write this story, because I was halfway through it, and I struggled through different renditions and versions, and I remember one very accomplished author telling me, you know, because I was trying to get it traditionally published first, she says, well, who's going to be interested? This is your grandmother wasn't famous, you're not famous. But, you know, I'm not easily deterred. Yeah, and I thought, you know, but, you know, I think I look around the world and there are so many stories, so many wonderfully brave people who struggle through life that we don't know about. And my grandmother was one of them, and it helped me know her, know my family, appreciate the roots. I
had to dig deep, Robert. I did. Yes. I it seems that way with the story. Were any members of your family beta readers? And how did they feel about you writing your grandmother's story?
Well, that was interesting because I kind of worried about that. I mean, when I wrote the story, I knew my uncles, you know, my mother's brothers, and as adults, and I didn't know them as children, but because of my family therapy background, I can kind of just sort of, in terms of their characters and their personalities, I was able to kind of get into their heads a bit, you know, because you do meet the other family members and their trials and tribulations. It is a family saga. So I wonder how my first cousins, whose uncles are still alive, how they feel about it. Anyway, I sent them all books to every one of them, and I did consult with a few in terms of what they knew, and I took, you know, I took some risks, I guess, because one uncle, you know, is not so reliable and responsible and easy to deal with. And so, you know, there's that. I mean, each of them had their journeys. Each family member had, you know, trials, I would say. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yes, that answered it perfectly. So let's switch gears, Diana. In a time where hundreds of thousands of books are published every year on so many different types of platforms, many authors want to know how they can make their book stand out from all the rest. How do you handle this? How do you handle the marketing aspect of being an author?
Oh, God, you know, that's a really good question, because I just put a post out on, this wonderful alliance of independent authors that I belong to, you know, just to sort of ask questions, how best do you advertise your book now, you know, whether it's Amazon or Facebook or Google, because I have not been, outside of my Facebook posts and Instagram and Twitter, I haven't spent any money on this book yet, and I should, because I'm, you know, I've been nominated, I'm now a finalist for the 2019 Whistler Independent Book Awards, which is sponsored by the Writers Union of Canada. So I'm over the moon about that, Robert. And
congratulations.
Thank you so much. But I have to let readers out there know that this book exists. So I'm planning to do some ads on Amazon and BookBub. What I did first of all, though, was I made sure that my book was could stand up to any traditionally published book, and I did that through, you know, putting it through my writer's critique group, many revisions, hiring professional editors, formatters, proofreader, book cover designer. So I did all of that first, and then I've been tweeting, but I don't think that's enough. So I have to get going and just raise this book's visibility. Just like traditionally published authors, they rely on the publishing house to do that kind of marketing for them to some degree, but they still have to, you know, get the word out as well, through
exactly.
Reviews and whatever. Yeah.
Yes, marketing is the 800-pound gorilla that authors, you know, especially no one's never realized. It's a 24/7, 365-day process. But so, Diana, let's talk social media. I know you're on Twitter and Facebook. Of the social media platforms, which one do you feel is the most beneficial for your brand, or does each platform offer its own special compensations?
Well, it's been interesting. Like Facebook, of course, I've had lots of sort of friends, family, that kind of thing, and they end up getting my book, you know, because they've seen it. And then I have, you know, attracted the odd stranger, I guess. Certainly I've made friends on Twitter who've ended up buying my book, you know, well-established authors. We've exchanged, you know, praise because we like each other's work, and so, you know, I've certainly had sales there, and I love it for a lot of reasons, not just, you know, selling my book. And Instagram, I'm playing with that now. I'm not sure quite how to do that, but I love taking photos, and so, you know, it's not a difficult thing for me to do. Yeah, I try to hit all the platform, and LinkedIn, I'm on that as well. It's a jungle out there, Robert. I'm just trying to navigate that, you know.
Literally, it's a jungle. You're right. And you know, like you, I'm starting to get better at Instagram and even Pinterest. Has really got my interest.
Yes.
I understand that's pretty good for authors. But in closing, Diana, what's next for Diana Steven? Movies of your books? What new irons do you have in the fire coming up?
Oh, it'd be wonderful to have movies in my book. I've had some recently. Oh, there's going to be a good movie because of my screen writing background, I tend to write cinematically. So I think that, you know, there's stuff there for certain. Next on my list is this sequel that I'm working on right now. And it's basically researching, you know, the Great Depression and how it affected, you know, Lucia Mazaretz and what was left of her family when they came to Canada. And I'm also working on a book of short stories. And then I have an inspirational nonfiction book that I've been playing with, and I've been giving away free chapters on my website, and that's called Along Came a Gardener. And that marries my my experience and thoughts about what was helpful to people I saw with my love of gardening and what nature teaches us. I think there's so many lessons there that I think are, you know, appropriate to, you know, that kind of fit in what, you know, what I think about, you know, this, these lives that we live and how we struggle to, you know, to make sense of them. Yeah, so I'm you know, working on that one. And you got another minute?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, Along Came a Gardener, I mean, that was that title came from poem that a girl in high school wrote me when I was helpful to her. Her and her sister had a schizophrenic mother, and they were, you know, they're very bright young women. And I guess that was helpful. And one of them wrote me this beautiful poem called The Garden of Hope, and I was the gardener that came along. And so so I thought, you know, she told me I could use it, but that was like, you know, we're talking decades later now, and I'm thinking, oh, you know, so that's what I've been working off of.
Oh, what a beautiful story. So, Diana, if people want to get in contact with you, can you give out your website address and any other contact info?
Yes, absolutely. It's my website is dianastevan.com. It's D-I-A-N-A-S, as in Sam, T-E-V-A-N.com. And my Twitter handle is at dianastevan. Anything else? Oh, and my email, dianastevan@gmail.com.
This has been the Author's Lab with me, Robert Batista. My mission is to give creative people a platform to show you who they are. One of my short stories, My Baby Has No Name, can be read for free online at spillwords.com. My guest has been Diana Stevan. Make sure you pick up her brilliant book, Sunflowers Under Fire. Thank you so much, Diana, for being my guest on the Author's Lab.
Thank you, Robert.
Have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. You too. Bye.
Bye. Bye now.